Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello and welcome. Today, June 24th, 2026, we are delighted to host this webinar discussing yesterday's rulings in Cisco Systems v. Doe and ExxonMobil v. Corporación Cemex. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. I will keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Professor Julian Koo and Ms. Molly Nixon as our speakers. Professor Koo is the Faculty Director of International Programs and the Maurice A. Dean Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Law at Hofstra University School of Law. Before joining the Hofstra Law Faculty, Professor Koo served as a law clerk to the Honorable Jerry E. Smith of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit and as an Olin Fellow and Lecturer in Law at the University of Virginia Law School. Ms. Nixon is the Senior Fellow in Executive Power at the Cato Institute. Before joining Cato, she worked as an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation's Separation of Powers Practice Group. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Professor Koo, the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you all for jumping on this call with us this morning. The Insta reaction to the Supreme Court decisions. So let me just start by giving a little bit of context. We're going to start first by talking about Cisco Systems versus Doe, and then we'll talk about that first. And then Molly will take over and lead the discussion of ExxonMobil versus Cemex. So let me just start with both cases are related to the same subject matter, but in a different way. So let me just start with Cisco Systems. Cisco Systems is it's the most recent and maybe the last U.S. Supreme Court decision on a longstanding academic and broader policy conversation about something called the Alien Tort Statute. So let me just set the stage first about the Alien Tort Statute before we get to the specific facts of that case. So the Alien Tort Statute is a provision which was part of the original Judiciary Act of 1789. And it's been there since literally the first Congress. So it and what it does is it allows it says that the federal courts, district courts, have jurisdiction for actions by aliens in tort and civil actions by aliens in tort. And this provision was in the Judiciary Act, but was really not invoked and used in any meaningful way for most of the history of the United States. And the real sort of energy with that provision and the reason it became a big deal, and the Supreme Court has now issued five or six decisions on it in the last 20 years, is that it began in the 1980s, to be invoked by litigants to bring lawsuits claiming violations of international law. And that's actually just to restate the Alien Tort Statute. It allows aliens to bring an action in, gives federal courts jurisdiction over civil actions for violations of the law of nations, which is another term for what we often call today customary international law. In the 1980s, sort of creative lawyers started bringing lawsuits alleging against foreigners on behalf of foreign people for violations of international law in U.S. courts, in U.S. federal courts. And this was pretty interesting and were often these pretty dramatic human rights cases. The first big case was Filartiga in the 1980, which was decided by the Second Circuit, upheld by the Second Circuit, which allowed basically someone to bring a lawsuit who was a member who's tortured by a police officer from Argentina. And they essentially said that the person Paraguay violated their international law, human rights. So in the, but the key thing is that it's a violation of international law, but it's being determined in a U.S. federal court, and the federal court has jurisdiction. So that case sort of spurred a bunch of other cases, maybe not a huge number, but a meaningful number of cases, often brought by NGOs in U.S. courts, U.S. federal court, alleging violations of international law, usually international human rights law, first against foreign government officials who happened to be in the United States, or but also in the 1990s, it started being brought against U.S. corporations on the theory that U.S. corporations were alleged, or foreign corporations as well, were alleged to aid and abet, or actually themselves engaged in violations of international law. And these are often always actions that occurred overseas. Now, just to say, this was controversial from the beginning, and there was a pushback. Famously, Judge Bork, before when he was on the D.C. Circuit, issued a decision being very skeptical of the idea that this statute could be used in this way. And there's been a lot of academic conversations about it and criticism of these lawsuits. And then as they were being brought against major corporations, it caused pushback by those corporations as well. Because the theory, again, is, yeah, I'm just a corporation. I'm in this case, I'm Cisco. In this case, the allegation was that their actions by working with providing certain services to the Chinese government allowed them to engage in human rights abuses in China. And the corporations were, had a variety of defenses, but among others is that we didn't do anything. We're not responsible for this. And you can't sue us for these. We're not even sure what the violation is, because it's, the claim is a violation of international law. So the Supreme Court in 2004 issued a major decision called Sosa versus Alvarez Machain, which resolved some of the longstanding criticisms of the statute. The criticism was it opens the door to basic claims under international law, which is a very vague area of law. And you could bring it against both corporations and foreign governments, causes all sorts of foreign policy problems. And we don't even know what this law was supposed to do when it was enacted in 1789. People are just kind of using it. And so the court in 2004 in Sosa cut back on the use of it. And they said, look, this is a statute that provides jurisdiction. And so it doesn't create causes of action. But because of the nature of the way the first Congress thought about things, they would have allowed the court to recognize causes of action under international law, some form of common law, even if Congress had not specifically created a cause of action under international law. And so we don't think that you can't ever use this law, because Judge Bork had argued you should just never be allowed to do this unless Congress creates a specific cause of action. But we don't agree with that. But we agree that we need to be very careful and limited in how we allow lawsuits to be brought under this statute, the Alien Tort Statute. And so they said it's jurisdictional, but you can use it to create causes of action if there is a widespread universal agreement that the thing that you're alleging is a true violation of international law. So this has been great for international law professors like myself who are interested, because this is, you can both give opinions on both sides. Like, it is a violation of international law, it isn't, and it comes into federal court. So it's been, there's been a very exciting area academically, even if there aren't that many lawsuits brought. But having said all that, the criticism in 2004, Justice Scalia issued a concurrence in that time, which said, look, you should just not allow new causes of action to be recognized. This is a jurisdictional statute. You said it's jurisdictional. It doesn't create a cause of action. You shouldn't allow lower federal courts to recognize new causes of action. It's just going to, they're just going to cause trouble and create more uncertainty. We should say, look, there are causes of action that existed in 1789 that maybe could be brought, but anything new international human rights law and things like that should not be something federal courts should be allowed to recognize. Which brings me to today. So the court has slowly been cutting back on the Alien Tort Statute over the years, and they never did actually uphold a new cause of action. They never recognized any new causes of action. The case here was brought against Cisco by members of the Falun Gong, which is a sort of a spiritual religious group that has suffered serious human rights abuses in China. But this lawsuit was brought against Cisco and arguing Cisco, a U.S. company, can be held liable for what the Chinese government did to the Falun Gong in China, because Cisco sold surveillance equipment that allowed them to identify and target people for human rights abuses. And so the court here, I think, and what's interesting about this case is this, the court took the opportunity in this case to say, look, we're going to cut back and say, this is, we're going to go back to where Justice Scalia would have wanted to go in 2004 and say, look, we still have the Alien Tort Statute as jurisdictional, but we're not going to allow the Alien Tort Statute to be used to recognize any new international law causes of action. And so we're going to close the door, because the court in 2004 said, we're leaving the door ajar for a few claims that maybe you can prove down the road. But now the court's saying, we're just slamming the door. No more cause of action. That's it. The Alien Tort Statute is limited to only those causes of action that would have been recognized in 1789, which are very distinct and limited to things like attacks against diplomats or violations of safe conducts. Very narrow cause of action that would rarely be brought today and certainly would not be allowed in this case. So that's sort of the, and that's the holding of this case by the opinion by Justice Barrett. Perhaps not surprisingly, her basic argument is that the court has never really recognized any new cause of action. Leaving the door open doesn't really make sense to allow lower courts to do so. It has a practical consequence because there have been settlements by corporations because they're afraid they don't know what's going to happen, so they make settlements. And nothing about this makes sense, given that we don't think that's what the purpose of the statute of 1789 was, to allow federal courts to even recognize a narrow set of very universal international law violations. That also is something that we don't think makes sense, given the overall purpose of this statute, and also the way the foreign relations separation of powers works under the U.S. Constitution. This is just an invitation for federal courts to create foreign relations problems for the U.S. government, like it did here, arguably, by essentially assessing Cisco and making a judgment that China has committed human rights abuses against the Falun Gong in China. So they shut the door. There was a dispirited dissent, but this is a pretty solid decision. I'll just say the last thing on this. This probably brings to an end Alien Tort Statute litigation in U.S. courts. What really began in 1980 probably ends with this case, because the court is saying we're not going to recognize any new causes of action. Let me just mention one other point. There was a statute called the Torture Victim Protection Act, which was also a basis for the lawsuit, which the court also read not to apply, because not for different reasons, because although Congress did create a cause of action, the court said they didn't intend for that to have aiding and abetting liability for torture. It's just only allows you to sue someone for actually subjecting someone to torture, which does not, according to the court, include like what Cisco is alleged to have done here, which is provide technical services to the government that then engage in torture, allegedly. So this is, I think, the end of any meaningful effort to bring these international human rights lawsuits in U.S. courts under the Alien Tort Statute. And it limits sharply what you can do under the Torture Victim Protection Act. So I'll talk a little more about what I think, but that's the basic gist of what I think is significant about this case. And I'll let Molly jump in now, since I've been talking a lot. Go ahead, Molly.
Yeah, I think what makes sense is I have a couple of questions or comments or thoughts on Cisco, and maybe you can respond to them quickly now, or we can save responses till after, and then I'll talk about the Exxon case. But so on Cisco, I'm not well versed in the ATS area, but the whole thing seemed odd to me. I think SOSA, the two-step process set up in SOSA, struck me as strange. The court inquiring whether there are sound reasons to think that Congress might doubt the efficacy or necessity of a damages remedy, like that seemed odd from an originalist or textualist court. I understand that I think none of the majority are on the court. None of the majority from SOSA are on the court today, but. This focus on whether courts are good or bad at doing foreign policy seemed almost beside the point. In my view, perhaps the question, like the heart of the question was, did Congress make the foreign policy choice to have courts identify or create, however you see it, these causes of action or not. So that was it seemed like a lot of the majority, especially, was focused on something that to me seemed tangential. And then perhaps related, I listened to the oral argument back when it happened. And there was an exchange between Chief Justice Roberts and the lawyer for the government, which I think was Curtis Gannon, where Roberts asked a question that I had been thinking about as well, which is, he said there was a conceptual challenge here in that the Congress that passed the ATS didn't think about causes of action the way we do today. And so trying to map on our current cause of action based system onto the ATS is hard to do. And I think the government acknowledged, you know, that this was, they were in sort of the awkward position of saying, the first Congress just didn't understand what we understand today. They were not as smart as us. And so that puts us in this awkward position of, we can't go back in time and explain to them how things actually work. So that was an interesting component of this case that I thought might get some attention in the opinions and really didn't, as far as I could tell when I read through them. One point that I quite appreciated was the point that I forget if this, maybe Gorsuch made it in an oral argument, but I can't remember if Barrett made it in the opinion or not, but that the fact that Sosa held out this possibility that the court might discover or create new causes of action really took the pressure off Congress to do much, to say, there are people that we want to be able to get into court that can't do it. We should create a cause of action. That's our job. We can do that. The fact that there's this possibility hanging out there after Sosa means Congress can say, well, the court knows what's doing. It'll figure it out. We don't have to do anything. And that reminded me a lot of something that people say a lot about the Bivens cause of action. One thing that this is the cause of action that the court said you can sue federal officers for monetary damages in the Bivens case. And people today will say that's been limited such that basically your name has to be Bivens to succeed on one of those cases. And I believe I have not read it or I know very little about it, but I think the court did take a Bivens case for next term. And I was wondering whether some of the language in this case about just we don't do causes of action, we don't do it at all, whether that portends anything for the Bivens case. I think one of the things you mentioned that you think this is sort of the end of the road for ATS, and I was wondering if that meant you think that Congress is definitely not going to create any more causes of action after this case. And maybe you could respond to it briefly to any of those that you want to now, and we could talk more after Exxon.
Yeah, let me just quickly say that, and sorry I went so long in the first part, that I really think that this reflects a longer trend of the court being hostile or critical of judicially created causes of action. Like the high point is probably the 70s, right? If you take the long view, and it's been slowly chipping away, and both in the con law context and in now here in the international law context. And so I think this kind of fits, and I think that that, as we'll see in the other case, I think there's a certain trend here. And the separation of powers, I think, is animating this. You know, this is not for courts to do. It's not our job. It's for Congress to do. There's definitely a flavor of that in this decision. And I think that's sort of what that's their best defense here. It's like, look, this is a very old statute. This is not the Constitution. Congress can fix and update this like they've done the rest of the Judiciary Act. So let's just not play around with it anymore and let Congress deal with it. And I don't know if Congress will, because I don't think they care that much and they're busy doing other things, but at least theoretically they could. And the court's going to, like with other things, kind of shove this off their plate. And I actually sympathetic to that, because I think the courts haven't really done a great job with this. It's very interesting, but this is a statute that Congress could amend at any time. They sort of amended a little bit with the TVPA, And, you know, this is not something that the courts need to sort of spend their time sort of, you know, entertaining and litigants. I just don't think it's a worthwhile, valuable thing for the courts to be doing. So I'm OK with the separation, which I always think was the strongest argument here. Separation of powers argument here, I think, always made sense because Congress can, as we'll see, if they want to let people sue foreign governments or foreign people, they know how to do it, and they've done so. So let me just turn it over to you then if you want to talk about the next case.
Yeah, just one follow-up that I thought now. I was curious. My understanding about the reasons for the passing the ATS are limited, but my sort of very high-level understanding was that there was concern that the United States would not be in compliance with international law if we did not provide this option. Right. And I was wondering if, in fact, the right interpretation is that we really did not provide the option. We provided jurisdiction, but not the option to sue. Have we been in violation of international law since 1789, at least as the first Congress would have seen it?
Yeah, it was a weird situation. I mean, what seemed to animate them were American mobs beating up ambassadors and diplomats, which definitely did happen, or just sort of taking foreign nationals and mistreating them. And the concern is that it would lead to war. There's actually a theory out there that that's what they really cared about, and therefore we should only care about things that would actually lead to that kind of serious reaction from a foreign government. But what's interesting about this is that, as far as we can tell, it was just never used. It was something they threw in there, but we had other ways of dealing with foreign governments that were more effective, like talking to them and so we didn't need to provide this. So this is kind of like, it was interesting, but not meaningfully practically important ever at that time or since.
Okay, now we'll move on to something that is likely very practically important. This is the ExxonMobil Corp, the Corporación Cemex case. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. The background here is after the Cuban Revolution at the end of the 1950s, Fidel Castro came to power and the Cuban government nationalized basically all U.S. property, confiscated it, confiscating assets. And as relevant here, they confiscated an oil refinery, terminals, packaging plants, and more than 100 service stations that were owned by subsidiaries of ExxonMobil's predecessor, which was Standard Oil. And the Cuban government-owned companies have been operating those assets ever since till this day. And they are the defendants in this case brought by Exxon. Next important happening is that the in 1996, Congress passed the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act, and everyone calls that the Helms-Burton Act, so I will as well. And that created, now we're talking about creating causes of action. That created a cause of action, a right of action for U.S. nationals that runs against, I'm going to quote here with a few ellipses, any person that traffics in property which was confiscated by the Cuban government after January 1st, 1959. And the act importantly defines person to mean any person or entity, including any agency or instrumentality of a foreign state. One note is that the, this is 1996, why are we discussing it just today? The Helms-Burton Act allows the president to suspend for renewable 6-month increments that right to bring a lawsuit. So they passed it in 1996, but every president since then until 2019 notified Congress that it was invoking this 6-month suspension. And the causes for doing that were that it's necessary to the national interests of the U.S. and will expedite a transition to democracy in Cuba. So that it's been suspended all the way through 2019. I believe the day the suspension was lifted, Exxon filed its case against the defendants, and they're seeking more than $1 billion in damages. And so great, Exxon can proceed. But the Cuban government's going to court and say, the Cuban defendants going to court and say, you know, wait, not so fast. We have sovereign immunity under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which was passed in 1976. And that law, before that, basically the State Department would make a determination about whether a foreign government should be immune for an action brought in a U.S. court. And the FSIA says, we're setting this default presumption of immunity for all foreign states, including their agencies and instrumentalities, but they're also waivable. There are a number of exceptions. The Cuban defendants say here none of those exceptions apply. I guess to set this up, where we are, all parties agreed going into this that you need both a cause of action and an abrogation of sovereign immunity. They disagree about whether the Helms-Burton Act itself provides both. It definitely provides the cause of action. The question here that the court has to answer is whether the Helms-Burton Act itself abrogates sovereign immunity such that you don't even apply the FSIA. The lower courts here said, this is the DC District Court and the DC Circuit both agree that the FSIA does apply, so that Helms-Burton itself does not abrogate sovereign immunity. There was some discussion about whether one of the defendants at least might have fallen within one of the exceptions. So the answer to this question from the court in an opinion by Justice Kavanaugh is that the Helms-Burton Act does on its own abrogate the sovereign immunity of Cuban agencies and instrumentalities. So the ExxonMobil and any other plaintiff does not need to separately satisfy an FSIA exception. And he gives four reasons for this. He says that the Helms-Burton Act expressly applies the cause of action against the Cuban government. And that is under precedent enough to satisfy sovereign or abrogate sovereign immunity. I'm not entirely sure that it does expressly do that, even though it does expressly define person as to be a government instrumentality. I'm not so sure it's expressed against the Cuban government, but that's the first argument. He also says, we presume that Congress does not enact self-defeating statutes. And so it would be very strange, he says here, if a plaintiff had to separately satisfy an FSIA exception, because the most potentially relevant exception for Cuban government instrumentalities is the one about whether they engage in commercial activity in the U.S. And he says the Helms-Burton Act, that's ridiculous because the Helms-Burton Act also codified comprehensive economic embargo against Cuba and barred commercial transactions between Americans and Cubans. And so he says they would have been creating a cause of action against a Cuban instrumentality that basically could never would never fit into an exception under the FSIA. Third, he says that this is sort of a technical argument, but he says the Helms-Burton Act courts have jurisdiction over this cause of action it creates under the federal question jurisdiction statute, whereas the FSIA jurisdiction granting statute is separate. And finally, he says the Helms-Burton Act for this cause of action is effectively analogous to a return to the pre-FSIA regime where the executive branch makes the decision about whether a foreign government is entitled to sovereign immunity in court. And so he says it makes sense to that suspension process is analogous to that regime. And so it makes sense to be read to be displacing that regime. There is a dissent, and again, I should mention, this is the same lineup that we saw in the Cisco case. So the dissent here is by Kagan, and it was joined by Sotomayor and Jackson. And Kagan makes a number of points. She says the definition of the statute defines person to be to include an instrumentality of a government, but that is defining the scope of the cause of action, not whether a particular state defendant can invoke immunity. And she points out that the act, she says, this might not be dispositive, but the act also amends the FSIA on a different question of immunity. And when Congress amends one statutory provision and not another, we presume that was intentional. She points out that an earlier version of the statute did include an FSIA exception for actions brought under the act, and notes that DOJ objected to that because it was a sweeping expansion of U.S. jurisdiction. Kavanaugh responds to that with an interesting point that I just don't know enough to really assess, but he says that that original part of the bill that didn't make it in was actually a waiver of immunity for the sovereign states themselves, whereas this definitional provision where we're getting the waiver here is really only agencies and instrumentalities of foreign states, and that is conceptually different in an important way. And then I think perhaps most importantly, Kagan makes several points that I would classify under what she refers to as the court's or the majority's tunnel vision in looking at the Helms-Burton Act. And that tunnel vision she identifies as focused as the majority being focused on claims brought against the Cuban government, because that's what's an issue here. But Helms-Burton, she says, was primarily focused on trying to deter private parties from investing in Cuba. And that's why the cause of action is about confiscated property, but it goes, the people you sue are the people who traffic in that confiscated property. In this case, that happens to be a Cuban government owned instrumentality. But she said most of the cases that Congress was looking at and was trying to incentivize in order to deter the action was against private parties that were trafficking in this property that had been owned by Americans. And so she says if it were true that the Helms-Burton Act created this cause of action that it immediately or simultaneously negated with this not arrogating sovereign immunity, she says that would be very persuasive. But it's not true, because the cause of action exists for all these private parties. It's definitely still available. In fact, the court decided a separate case, Helms-Burton Act case, earlier this year. It's the Havana Docks case against a cruise ship company, saying that the case could proceed on whether they were trafficking in confiscated property. And she says, and in addition to private parties, we also see that there might be exceptions to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that would apply here and might still apply in this case that was still undecided when the Supreme Court took it. So she says there's not a negation enough to assume the abrogation of sovereign immunity by the act itself. She also makes a point that I wish the majority had given more attention to, because I thought it was the most interesting thing that, if I remember correctly, came up in oral argument. She says, if it was as simple as the majority says, they wouldn't have to do this one thing that they did in a footnote, which was to say, we're not deciding whether the act abrogates the immunity of non-Cuban foreign instrumentalities. And that's really important, because the operative cause of action language that the majority is relying on defines the person trafficking in confiscated property to include foreign agencies and instrumentalities, not Cuban foreign instrumentalities. And that's why I said, I'm not sure if it's as specific as Kavanaugh says. There are other parts of the act that do obviously contemplate suits against the Cuban government, but not the one that creates not the cause of action itself. And I think Barrett, if I remember correctly, Barrett raised that in oral argument. And the answer was sort of like, you don't have to decide that here. And so they don't decide it here, but the logic of the opinion to me would have required, probably compels that conclusion. Maybe not. I'm sure there are arguments, but I thought that was a really important point that was not satisfactorily addressed to my mind. Kagan makes some other points, but I'm running short on time, so I'll just end with some quick thoughts. One of which is that the standards that both the majority and the dissent cite for when we know that Congress meant to abrogate sovereign immunity seem to me very different. And they agree that these are like the same thing. They cite them as like one of them is clearly the abrogation must be clearly discernible from the sum total of Congress's work. And then they say that means basically the same thing as like unmistakably clear in the language of the statute. And to me, these are just very different standards. I think something can be clearly discernible from the sum total of Congress's work. I'm not sure that's the same exactly as unmistakably clear in the language. That said, no one addresses that, but it was a question I had moving after that. There's also a separation of powers angle that Kavanaugh touches on toward the end, which is that he says, you know, statute, this particular statute confers this gatekeeping function. He's very focused on this suspension power on the president, not on the courts. One point that Kagan makes that I thought was a good one is the suspension applies to everyone. It's not just the president can suspend it for suits against Cuban government or their instrumentalities. If the president is suspending the cause of action, it's suspended for suits against any private party as well. I guess one final thought on this case was that I found the dissent pretty persuasive, but it does result in just a strange outcome. I don't think there's a legal issue here, but in light of the Havana Docks case, the outcome, if the dissent had under this dissent's reading, which again, I think is persuasive, is that private parties that really didn't do anything wrong, speaking loosely here, like the cruise company in Havana Docks that was being sued for activity in 2019, like long after the confiscation, they're liable for a lot of money, whereas the Cuban government, the actual bad actor here, would not be under the Sovereign Immunities Act. And so I think that would have been a strange result. And so in some ways, I'm sympathetic to the majority in that way, but worth noting. I'll turn it over to Professor Koo.
That's great, Molly. And I think I'm sympathetic also to the textual argument that, you know, there's a way that to read this statute that it makes sense, that you can sort of allow these lawsuits, allow the cause of action to be effective, but still not abrogate sovereign immunity, right? I think that, and you know, I'm old enough to remember when this statute was enacted, and the main complaints were about its ability to sue private companies, foreign companies, and the main purpose was to go after those foreign companies and deter them from doing business in Cuba, right? This is an attempt. This is really about our Cuba sanctions policy, and it was expansion of our Cuba sanctions policy to not just sanction embargo Cuba effectively, this is the part which is more controversial, is to try to prevent other companies from other countries or people from other countries from doing business in Cuba as well. And so that was the idea behind, and that's what made this statute controversial abroad, European companies and such. And so it kind of makes sense to say, look, that, and that this was not about, because there are other ways to go after the Cuban government, right? And Cuban companies. However, it's ambiguous, I think. I think the broader legal point is, how clear do we have to be to abrogate sovereign immunity, which is about it. Sovereign immunity is important. And I do think there's a flavor of the same approach, the same thinking that's animating both the Cisco case and this one, which is that the court wants Congress to make these decisions. And so when Congress does something, they're going to say, okay, Congress, you want to punish Cuba and lawsuits. That's good. We'll let you do it. You know, that's what you want. We'll give effect to that. But if unless you're clear, but you don't necessarily want to open the door to any lawsuit against any country for any violation of international law, that's the ATS. We're going to shut the door there. So to some degree, there's a flavor of separation of powers animating both these cases that could be read consistently, which is that Congress wants to go after Cuba. They want to allow lawsuits to Cuba. They created a specific cause of action. We'll let them do that. The Alien Tort Statute is just not that clear, and we don't think that's what they really wanted to do. And it will allow courts to really direct who gets sued and under what for what violations. And we don't like that. So we're not going to shut that down. So I think there's a little flavor of separation of powers that animates both of these cases and explains maybe why they reached that result. But I do think that the Kagan's dissent, I think, was persuasive for the reasons you suggested, even though I think as a practical matter, it would be a bizarre result. And, you know, I think it's not clear what Congress and really necessarily intended at that time. To say quickly, I didn't give enough. I forgot to talk about Sotomayor's dissent in Cisco. Let me just quickly. I think it's a little bit. So this actually raises a bigger issue for the court. Sotomayor raises the point that the court in Cisco is overruling the 2004 Sosa decision, but they're not explaining that they are. And so she spends a lot of her dissent pointing this out, that this is not just amending or interpreting Sosa. They're just overruling it, but they're not saying it. And this is a bad trend. And I don't like this. And the court's doing this. You know, they did this in SFFA with the affirmative action case. This is a bad trend. And I want to put my marker down and point out that's what's happening here. I don't know if that's, I quite agree with her, but there's some force to her point that Sosa clearly left the door ajar and the court's closing it here, but they're not admitting that they're overruling it. Overruling is a little bit strong, but they are definitely altering the result in a meaningful way. So the practical consequence is going to be meaningful. And that's an interesting question broadly for the court is, when exactly are they overruling something? And how do we know? And should they be more explicit about doing so? And that's sort of where I think that was effective in raising that point in her dissent. But, you know, I think I guess we don't have any questions, so we can talk more then. So I don't know if you'll let you talk a little bit more about.
Yes, I have one question. I was trying to last night and this morning, I kept asking myself, are these cases related? Are they actually like, is there a tension there? Are they related? I think you did a very, I like your effort to reconcile them if they even need to be reconciled, and they might not. But I think your point is well taken. One thing that I did think about is that the one of the things that these cases have in common is, I believe, that the executive branch is not a party. The U.S. government is not a party to either, but it did participate as an amicus in both. And I believe the U.S. government's position was adopted in both. I think I have that right. And so I was wondering, you know, could someone make an argument that all of this talk about the text and the intent and the policy arguments are all for show, and the court is just doing what the president wants in two foreign affairs cases? I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think this is part of a longer conversation. I don't think this is a Trump administration question. So, I guess that sort of makes it, I wouldn't say that it's, I mean, I think the difference is that the different administration might have not supported, you know, and sought the results that they sought here. But I think they're kind of leading in that direction already. I think they're heading in that direction. I see a point here made by Professor Clark that on the SOSA point, let me just respond quickly, they didn't overrule it because it was sort of dicta. Like the SOSA holding was not really, it was really dicta because SOSA, the actual case, did close the door for that cause of action. So yeah, that's fair. I do think though it's a meaningful change in the approach. And I think, I think that's fair to say that it's not quite the same as overruling. I take his point. His point's well taken. I do think that this is part of a longer trend, and that people like myself have been advocating that the court get out of the ATS business because I think it's for separation of powers. But I'm also sympathetic to the general point, even if not the specific point, that when Congress wants to direct our foreign policy, they should be allowed to, and the court shouldn't be a persnickety about it. because Congress often doesn't say what they want to do, but when they do, we probably should not be too fussy about allowing them to, because I think it's clear the intent is to pummel Cuba and the president, you know, and so I don't, so I think that, and I said, and that's okay. That's actually what they're allowed to do. I don't think Congress and the president are at odds here, I guess is what I'm saying. And so I don't think, Congress has any strong views on the ATS either. And I think this is a part of a larger conversation that's going to be okay. I'm happy with the results here. I think this is the right approach for separation of powers reasons. Congress and the president get to decide who we sanction, who we don't, and what kind of lawsuits for what private cause of action if we allow it, and whether we abrogate sovereign immunity. But the technical, whether they actually did so clearly, is a little bit murkier.
I should say I don't have strong feelings about the results. I know you have a hard out soon, but I am less satisfied by the reasoning in these in both opinions, like the cleanliness of the legal reasoning. I don't think I mentioned it before, but one of the when I said that I don't think this the current cause of action system maps on to what Congress thought it was doing in the ATS, I was got that impression from an article several years ago by Professor Clark and Professor Belli, I think, that we were talking about before. So if I didn't mention them, I should have, because I think having that article in the background of my mind, in the back of my mind while I was reading the Cisco opinion, left me sort of wishing, I need more. I need more explanation for what you think you're doing here from an originalist point of view.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think legally I'm a little underwhelmed with both results. I'm not sure Kavanaugh totally wins in his argument. And Barrett resolved, I guess the Barrett resolved the long-running ATS without answering any of the interesting academic questions that we all want. So maybe more law review articles can be written, although there, but she didn't really dive into it and even really didn't cite a very rich literature. I think probably because she didn't want to sort of just create more confusion, just wanted clean end to the sort of the saga of the ATS. But I agree that it's a little bit disappointing, especially in the ATS context, which is very interesting. I do think that as a practical matter, we're going to see a lot of the idea that you can just aggregate sovereign immunity in this way could be potentially a big deal if for other things that you might have opened the door to other kinds of lawsuits against sovereign immunity arguments that might have existed. ATS, I think it's important. ATS is over essentially, but we may see a bunch of new cases under Helms-Burton now. So Matthew, I'll let you close. Yeah.
I think we're out of time. I wish we had more time to continue the discussion. We'll wait for a law review article from you, Professor. There's more, but yes. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Professor Koo and Ms. Nixon, for your time and expertise today. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep your eye out on your emails and on our website for upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.